We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everyone. My name is Elizabeth Reyes, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Woo! A little bit nervous this morning. I'd like to take a moment to thank Vanessa and Dan and the committee for inviting me to speak here. I know it takes a lot of work being in the committee and planning this event, so I'm very grateful to be here. And I also understand that not a lot of people get the opportunity to be here and be a part of this deal, so I understand that this is a privilege for me, and for that I am very grateful. I'm going to do my best to share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And you may hear a little bit of an accent. I was born in the Dominican Republic. My father was the alcoholic in my family. My mom was the rager. I had three older brothers. And so in my family, the alcoholism started very early. I wouldn't see my father very often. My father worked in the United States. And so he would only come maybe a couple of years, every other year or so. When he would come to visit us, his visits would only be for about a month or so, and 3 weeks out of that month, he would be out binging with his buddies and drinking. And then we'd get him back for that last week when he was just passed out, recovering from his hangover. And I loved my dad, especially when he was drunk, because I could get a lot of things out of my dad when he was drunk, especially money. So I learned that tool of manipulation very early on, and I would ask him money for like a Barbie car, and I hated Barbies, but I thought, you know, that was the thing that he would want to hear in order for him to give me money, and he would give me money, and I love my dad. My dad was a very fun alcoholic, very lighthearted, very loving. He used to buy coconut macaroons, and he used to hide them inside under the car seat, and we used to play this game, and my part in that game was to find the coconut macaroon. So I love my dad. My dad could never do anything wrong. The person that I had issues with growing up in my alcoholic home was my untreated mother. My mom had us three kids. She had four kids total to raise. And then we took in a godbrother on top of that. And my mom was a rager. There wasn't any day that I can remember that my mom wasn't cursing or yelling about anything and whatever at any given time. So there was a lot of fear growing up in my household. There was also a lot of violence growing up in my alcoholic home. My mom was that primary person that did that. She used to use, belts, broomsticks. And if you were really bad, we used to have like these graters that were made out of like big peanut oil cans. And if you were really bad, she would make you kneel on those in front of the garden in the sun. If you were really bad, that was your punishment. So there was a lot of that growing up. Growing up was very confusing in my household, because then on Sundays, she would put me on a dress, and then she would give me this doll that I would always get for Christmas that I never wanted, and I would just basically be sitting in the living room for everybody to watch. That life was normal. I wanted Transformers, I wanted cars, I wanted to get dirty with my brothers. So things were very confusing growing up in my alcoholic home. When my dad would come over to visit, the roles would change, and to me that was very confusing, because all of a sudden this man was the head of the household and whatever he said wanted. We used to have baby chickens, we used to have lots of pets, and guess what? If my dad wanted chicken for dinner, one of our pets would be missing. If dad wanted the cat to be gone, guess what? The cat would be gone. And there was never a group conscience around that in my household. We never talked about it. It was always whatever he said happened. And that, I was very angry about that because I didn't understand it. Whatever meal he wanted, my mom would cook, and then she would be cursing afterwards because she would be resentful about it. And I just remember growing up and feeling like I would never give my power away to a man. And I never did. I gave my power away to women. And so, you know, in my household, there were a lot of secrets. All of a sudden, we got news that I had a half-sister, because when my dad would drink, he had extracurricular activities with other women. And next thing you know, I have a sister. And guess what? She's going to be a part of the household. And yet again, there's no group conscience. No one had a vote. We're not going to talk about that. We're just going to throw her into the family and pretend like nothing happened. And I just remember having this innate feeling inside of me that, you know, I'm feeling threatened. You know, being the only girl in a house full of boys, there was no expectations of what that needed to look like. But now there's another girl in the household. And I had this feeling deep down inside of me that I was going to be found out, whatever that meant. And so that was very uncomfortable. Around the age of 9 and 10, we were able to come to the United States, and we were going to migrate to Los Angeles. And my sister wasn't able to join us because her biological mother wouldn't allow her to be a part of. We also had a problem where my older brother couldn't come and join us. And it was then that we found out that my older brother really wasn't our biological brother. He was our half-brother. And again, it was just like, okay, we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to sweep that under the rug. That's no big deal. He's going to join us later. And that's what it was like growing up in my alcoholic home. We migrated to Los Angeles, and here we were supposed to assimilate this family. My dad was never used to having a family to take care of, and there was a lot of conflict. If my mom wanted something nice in the household, it was something that she would have to supply for herself, because dad was very much of, you have food and shelter, that's all you need. And so I learned a lot of those messages growing up in my alcoholic home. The abuse continued in my alcoholic home, and I couldn't wait to do it different. I couldn't wait to get out of there and show them that I'm going to do things differently, because that's not how I want to live my life. But what I didn't know and realize is that I was already affected and infected by the disease of alcoholism. So I couldn't help but do what was modeled for me. And in my alcoholic home, you know, the anxiety was right around the drinking. You know, right around 6 o'clock on a Friday night, my dad couldn't wait to get home from work, and he would have his rum and coke ready. And I just remember having that anxiety and feeling that uncomfortable feeling until about Sunday afternoon, when he would have to come down from all of that with beer. And it was crazy. It was crazy. I just, till this day, I was even sharing with my partner earlier today, I can't be around alcohol because I have some weird anxiety around all of that. I still have that cellular uncomfortability around alcohol. And so I did really well in school. That was my way of getting out of myself. But school was difficult because here I was, a Hispanic kid, in a predominantly Hispanic area in Los Angeles, but people didn't accept me because I was dark-skinned and I knew Spanish. So people automatically assumed that I was either Puerto Rican or Cuban. And I wasn't very accepted. So from a very, very young age, I knew that there was something wrong with me. Another part of my story, which is the tape that I struggle with a lot, which is the base of my story, is my mom tells this story that when I was born, she wanted a girl. She had a house with three boys, and she wanted nothing more than to have a girl. And on her birthday, she got me. And so we shared the same birthday, but I was born preemie. And my mom tells this story that when I was born, she said that I was ugly. And she gave me to my grandmother to raise until I was presentable enough. And so I come to you with this underlying story of being a disappointment, being not good enough. And once I heard that story, it validated the violence in my household. It validated the alcoholism in my household because, you know, I was a disappointment, you know. And so I couldn't wait to get out of there and do it differently. And so my way to do that was to seek out people that were completely 100% different from me. I wanted nothing with people that were like me because I didn't feel loved by people that were like me. And so I began at a very young age to look for higher powers in other people. I made them my higher power. And so I became best friends with this girl that was punk rock, atheist, vegetarian, Mohawk. She used to be a Nazi skinhead, and I didn't think anything of it. She said the right thing. She said, your parents are a-holes, and that's all she needed to say. And then it was like, oh, my God, my higher power. I overlooked everything else because in my alcoholic home, I learned to make permanent decisions with temporary information, you know. And so that was my higher power. Never mind that there was untreated alcoholism, never mind that she could be mentally unstable, never mind all that. She said that my parents were a-holes, and that's all that I needed. During that time, my parents moved away. I didn't have any tools to learn how to find an apartment. I moved in with her and her family, and there was untreated alcoholism in that family, but to me, that felt normal. I knew how to handle that. And there was the occasional, suicide attempt. There was the occasional drinking, there was all of that, and I was the designated driver. I was the one that kept everybody legit. I knew how to fit in there, but I knew that it was getting to be too much for me, and I didn't have any tools. So once I was able to have a real job, I was able to have benefits, the first thing I did was I went to a professional because I needed the professional to tell me how screwed up my family was and how good it was for me to be who I was. You go to the professional, you tell them your life spiel, and the first thing that the professional says is, do you know of Al-Anon? And I said, no. I just need you to tell me that my parents are screwed up and that I'm okay being who I am, and that's all that I need. And they did, and I didn't take up the suggestion. So that was that. Life in that household was becoming very chaotic, and I knew that I needed an out. And for me, the way outs looked like in my house, you needed to put, you needed a plan B. And so that was the era of online dating. And so I began to try to find that solution outside of myself. This is also the part of my story where I get to tell you that I remember most of my partners by the drink that they drank. And so this is in the part of my story where I met Dirty Martini. Dirty Martini was older, sophisticated, and again, said the right things. Part of who she was a drug and alcohol counselor for the city of Los Angeles, California. And there again, that's all I need. That must mean that you don't drink. That must mean you don't want anything to do with this. That's my out. And so I started my life with Dirty Martini, and life was becoming unmanageable, and I didn't understand what was going on. Within 6 months of being together, there was pot in the household, and I thought, well, at least it's not alcohol. And then within a year of the relationship, there were other substances, and it became a business. Our household, there was business of other substances in our household. In Al-Anon, we talked about, the three C's. We didn't cause it. We can't cure it. We can't control it. We only have the power to contribute to the situation. And I was a very bad contributor to the disease in that household. I remember we needed a big screen TV for our house, or I wanted a big screen TV for the house, and I used to say, here's $300. I know you could double this and make it $600 for that TV, but I don't want you to tell me how you make that happen.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And and so I contributed to the disease. You know, if, so long as I didn't see it, it didn't happen. And, you know, my car was funded that way. My down payment on the car was, you know. But again, I don't want you to tell me how it happens. I just need for you to make it happen. And, you know, we got very sick. And again, I didn't know of Al-Anon. I didn't know of any tools. I didn't know that there was anything different. Little by little, everything started to crumble around me because I made babysitting the deceased person in my life my full-time job. All of a sudden, I couldn't go to work. All of a sudden, I needed to control what was going on in my household. I needed to control the traffic, make sure that people were out by 10 o'clock at night. And it got very insane. I couldn't go to work and have a feeling at the same time, so I had a different mask for everything. I used to overachieve at work to escape from my home. Then when that didn't work, I would go to my family of origin and put another mask for that. And when that didn't work, it was just getting insane. There were issues in my family of origin that I couldn't deal with. I found out that my older brother had mental issues and I didn't have any tools for deal with that, so I withdrew from that. I was losing my job because I was spending too much time babysitting the sick person in my household. And then the loving partner that I was supposed to have in my household didn't work, wasn't working either. So I go to a professional because that's what I know to do. I go to the professional again and do my live spiel. Next thing they say is, have you heard of Al-Anon? I'm like, God, do they all get the same, line of question, like, do they all share the same information? What's going on? And I said, okay, I'll give it a try. So I go to Al-Anon, and here in California, the meetings are an hour and a half long, and I was like, wow, an hour and a half. I go to this meeting in Santa Monica, California, and there's this kid crying about how his family of origin was breaking up because his dad had an affair, and he was just bawling. He was just crying. And even though I could relate to what that's like, I made a decision that that wasn't for me because I didn't have it that bad. You know, these people were sicker than me. And then at the end, you wanted to hold hands and chant, this is a cult. That's not going to work for me. And because I had made my higher power, usually other people's beliefs, my life's tools were your life tools. So if you told me that God hated me, then I believe that God hated me. So I just said to the professional, okay, I went to the Al-Anon thing. It didn't work for me. I just need you to tell me that my partner's sick and I'm okay. And then we can move on with our lives. And she did say, you know, your partner is sick and you might need to do some work. And that's all I needed to hear. And I never saw the therapist again. I needed to make my life more manageable. I wasn't sick enough yet, to come into these rooms. And so life was getting unmanageable again. I couldn't show up for work. I wasn't keeping it together. So Dirty Martini decided to get sober, and we made the move to Arizona. And I thought Arizona would be great. There's no drugs and alcohol in Arizona. Today I know that's called a geographic. And I went there with the premise because her parents said, we're going to buy you a house if you come out to Arizona. So that was my motive for making the trip. And they're going to get clean on top of that. Life is going to be great. But it wasn't very long until there was a community of disease around us, the disease that followed us. And again, I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. And so I started to know... I didn't have any friends because the other thing that I knew is that if I made you my higher power, that's all that I needed. I couldn't have friends and be in a relationship at the same time. You know, you were my ultimate authority. And so I started becoming friends with the people around us. And so I knew, again, my plan, my only way to get out of that is to start another relationship. And it was then that I met the Incredible Hulk. Hypnotic and Hennessy. It turns green when you stir it. And just like the drink suggests, very unpredictable, very angry. And again, ultimate, you know, Incredible Hulk said the right things. You know, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years. I was a double winner. I had a black belt, Al-Anon sponsor, and here we go. You know, that's all that I need. I need for you to tell me the right thing. Never mind, though, that we used to go out every weekend and drink and dance. But again, I wasn't going to meetings. I wasn't going to open AA meetings. So to me, that meant that she was cured. She went to Alcoholics Anonymous enough that she was able to drink normally. And I wasn't going to meetings, so I didn't know any better. And so left Dirty Martini and started this relationship with the Incredible Hulk, but that was mostly in my head. Again, here's a chance for you to become my ultimate authority. Here's a chance for you to become my everything, and I still don't know how to make friends and be in a relationship at the same time because you're going to be my everything. You're going to be my higher power. And that just became insane. I was lined up for a promotion at work, and I was ready. I thought my life was getting great. We had thoughts of getting a house together. Love was going to be wonderful, but most of that was all in my head. Went out one night, came back home, and the Incredible Hulk was with someone else, and my life was devastated. But like an incredible Al-Anon that I am, I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to show you. I'm going to do you one better. And so we were supposed to move into this house together. My solution for that was to get a condo on the other side of town that I couldn't afford. You know, because that's, you know, I'm going to harm me to show you. And so I got into this condo that I couldn't afford all by myself. And again, how do I make myself feel better? I'm going to find somebody else that's going to want me. And so then I found Fat Tire. And, you know, and again, this is what I know to do. You know, this is the only way I know how to make my feel better is to find another person. Because I can't stand the way I feel inside of my skin. I need for you to make me feel better about myself. And so it was a perfect fit. I had the condo. She had the furniture. You know, and it was great, you know, and before I left the Incredible Hulk, I also got news that my grandfather was getting sick, and I just remember feeling devastated, and I just remember laying on my couch and praying that helpless prayer that we say, which is, God, help me, and the message that I got a day or so later was, go to Al-Anon, and I just thought, go to Al-Anon, okay, you know, but I didn't have any friends. And I thought, okay, I'll go to Al-Anon. And that was September 26 of 2006. And I went to that meeting, and I cried. I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And I got my newcomers packet. And they used to, in that meeting, they give you a 24-hour chip. So I had that in my pocket, and that saved me. I used to be scared, because now that I didn't have that ultimate authority in my life, now that I don't have the higher power in my life, I didn't know how to do life. So I used to grab my 24-hour chip, and I used to say the serenity prayer from between my house and the door. You know, between the door and the car, I would say it again. And I used to keep the just for today's on my visor, and I would pick one of those things to do before I make it to work. And that just helped me get over that fear, because I didn't know how to be myself without any other person. And so you guys suggested that I get a sponsor, and I did, because I want to do this right. But I signed up for the crisis, you know, the crisis plan, which is, I only want you to be available to me when I have a crisis. And so I just remember my memories of meeting with that sponsor was, did you read step one? Yes. Did you understand step one? Yes. Okay. Do you want to go to step two? Yes. Okay. Did you read step two? Yes. Did you understand step two? Yes. Do you want to go to step three? Yes. You know, and I used to sit at meetings and look at these 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and I said to myself, you know, how are these things going to help me find a partner? How is this going to help me get the house that I want? How is this going to help me how to pay my bills? you know, and I was very selective. I went down the line, and you guys talked about this magical fourth step, and in Al-Anon we have that blueprint for progress. That's the workbook, and I thought that's the magical book with the answers. And so I decided that, you know, I downgraded my sponsor program, and I decided to sponsor myself. Because now that I have this magical book that has all the answers, I don't need you. And so I went on this journey. I'm doing this inventory all by myself. You know, and I love, you know, looking at what people had done to me. I love writing it down, blaming other people. I was learning all kinds of things about myself, but I wasn't going to meetings very often. I wasn't checking in with a sponsor. I was sleeping with this person that was taking up my electricity and everything else that I couldn't stand, but I didn't know how to leave them. And my thought was, I can't ask them to leave. They have the furniture. And that was my best thinking at the time. I was lining up for a promotion. I forgot to sign up for, I had signed up for an overtime shift, and I forgot that I signed up for it, so that counted as an occurrence. And that to me was that wasn't gonna give me that promotion, and I felt shame. And so my solution to that was, I just won't go to work. And so what would happen would be, I would pretend like I would get ready for work, I would leave. Then once Fat Tire would go do her things, I would come back to the house and I would barricade myself in that house with this fourth step inventory. And I did that day after day after day after day. And then I had two solutions because my life was becoming increasingly unmanageable, and that was either I was gonna kill myself or I was gonna go to the military. I thought that if I went to the military, I would get buff, I would travel, and I would have purpose in my life. But luckily, you know, God had other plans, and I decided to find work in the behavioral health field because now I think that I can fix people. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I was able to find another job because I had money in a 401k. I was able to have money to move and get out of that relationship. And I said, okay, you know, I'm gonna do these steps. I'm gonna commit now. My sponsor started getting busy, and he said, I know you're fond of this other person in this meeting. Why don't you continue to do the steps with her? And I said, okay. And to me, that's an example of how the program carries you, because I had no ability to pick anything good in my life. I really didn't. And so I started to do the steps with this person in this meeting, and she was one of those, you know, I'm a bolter. When I first came in, as soon as the hour passed, I was bolting out that door. And she would always wait and give me a hug. And she would say things like, you know, we need a literature person. Do you think you can do it? And I was like, oh, I feel needed. And so I got that commitment. And then she would say, you know, we have this other Thursday night meeting that needs a group representative. Do you think you could do that? It's a 3-year commitment. 3 years? Woo! To me, that was like going from janitor to CEO of a company, and I couldn't commit to that. And she just reminded me, you know, it was one meeting at a time, one step at a time, and she got me in the middle of the boat. So we continued doing our step work. We went through the steps, and my sponsor was one of those that said, come on, get in the car, we're gonna go somewhere. And she knew that I didn't have a life, so I didn't have an excuse. So we would go to assemblies. She was very involved in service. She was a district rep, and she did area service, so she would take me to assemblies. One of the events that she took me to was an AA conference with Al-Anon participation. And the Al-Anon speaker shared about having a void inside of her. And for the very first time, I understood what that felt like. And I felt like, oh, I'm in the right place. And you guys also said, you know, to not make any major decisions within that first year. But I had changed jobs, changed partners, and moved within that first year. That didn't apply to me. And you guys said, you know, why don't you finish the steps before you get into a relationship? I translate that to mean finish the steps and you could have a relationship. And so I was doing the steps like a checklist. You know, I wasn't internalizing them. I wasn't practicing them. I just wanted you guys to give me that seal of approval that said I could be in a relationship. And after that conference, something came over me. And I remember coming out of that conference and telling my sponsor, I think I want to go back and do the steps over. And I know that was my higher power because I wanted just to finish my steps so that I can be in a relationship. And so I started my journey with the steps, you know, and I recognized that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. I knew what my insanity
thought, oh my God, what if the cops pick him up?
Especially me a great gift, and that was to work on my mommy issues. Because everybody around me could see that everything stemmed from seeking that love from that unavailable mother that I had growing up. And I could get it here, but it never went down here. And I just remember feeling like, God, why does everybody else see this except for me? And I just remember praying and saying, God, you're going to have to show me. You're going to have to knock me down with the 2x4. What is it about this dynamic that keeps me doing the same insane behavior? And a couple of days later, what came to me was this image of this little girl walking around, tugging at someone's pants, saying, why don't you love me? Why don't you love me? And it was then that I began to realize that maybe there is something to this higher power, that if I can come to him for help, he would be able to help me. And so maybe this higher power thing wasn't bad after all. And for me, the idea of having a higher power became easier to understand because I needed a buffer. You know, the definition of allergy is having an adverse reaction. And that's what I felt like my whole life, that I had an adverse reaction to life. And for me, I needed a higher power that would make that feel better, because leaving it to my own devices, I believed I had the power to screw things up. And if I left it to the hands of other people, they would leave. And so the idea of a higher power helped me because I knew that I needed that buffer between me and life. And so we continued to do step work, and we did that fourth step inventory. And so I did an inventory solely on my mother. And it was then that I began to realize that my mother was only doing what was taught to her. I began to see the good qualities in my mother. She taught me how to pray. She taught me how to cook. And you know, my mother raised my first brother before she even had her own children. And it was just like, wow, she's just a human being doing what she knows how to do. I also knew that I had to do a sexual inventory, because I kept going to that same, I kept reenacting that behavior, wanting to feel better about myself by being with another person, you know. And it was then that I realized that I used that to feel better. It was then that I realized that I did that to control, and that no longer was the tool that served me. And so 6 and 7 for me was about learning, what is it that I'm getting out of these character defects? You know, what is it that I'm getting out of being under the influence of anger? What is it that I'm getting out of being under the influence of self-righteousness? What is it that I'm getting out of being under the influence of isolation? And that was the most change that I've ever experienced, because it was an opportunity to see, for me to see how I was separating myself from you, and how that wasn't using my higher power at all. Being in an alcoholic home, I was this child walking around with all these open wounds. And so I felt like I had to lash out with self-righteousness, because I was going to hurt you before you hurt me. And it was in step 6 and 7 that I realized that I have a higher power that is my shield. That's my protector. I don't have to defend myself anymore if I use these tools. And then we started doing the amends. And, you know, in Al-Anon, in some of our literature, it talks about having the three list. You know, yes, maybe, hell no. And there were people on my hell no list. Incredible Hulk was one of them. My mom was another one of them. And it was very uncomfortable. And so I decided to treat myself with a little tequila while that was happening, because I didn't want to have to look at that. You know, and my life was unmanageable because I was so busy taking care of the alcoholic. I didn't take care of myself. I didn't take care of my finances. The car wasn't getting paid. I wasn't keeping insurance. And so I was going to try to do things differently now, because I have some steps. I have some tools. I have a sponsor. I'm doing this right. I'm being of service. But yet the registration wasn't up to date on the car. I wasn't taking care of any of that. So go on my first date with tequila. And I knew, you know, my sponsor suggested do the 30, 60, 90, you know, get to know somebody for 30 days before you kiss them. Hang out with them after that until the 60th day, and then you start making out, start getting closer. And then after 90 days, you can sleep with them. And, you know, and I remember that first date. She was very persuasive. She wanted to get down to what we girls know how to do fast. And I was just like, no, I have program now, I can't do that. And so I was just racing to get tequila back home, and there were cops behind us, and I didn't have registration, I didn't have insurance on the car, and the sirens went off, and I just remember texting my sponsor saying, I think the car's gonna be taken away now. And I remember looking at the rearview mirror and saying the serenity prayer, and my sponsor just replied back, good luck. you know? She knew, and she told me about my circumstances, and she knows, she told me about the possible consequences of doing what I wasn't supposed to do, like driving with a car without registration and insurance. And so the first date, we got to ride back home in a cop car. You know, and I do this, you know, I don't need a drink to be sick. I don't need that drink to be sick. And so tequila does what tequila does, and it knocks you on your butt. And I was working on my steps. I was getting my stuff together. I was a financially responsible human being, and tequila left to chase her disease. And I was pissed off at God, because I thought, God, here I am doing some step work, getting my stuff together, and this person leaves to chase a disease. But at the same time, it's also what I needed from my higher power to make me see the dynamic of the disease that I never saw before. And it's that powerlessness of what the disease looks like. And it was then that I made a commitment that I was only going to do this disease 100%, that I was no longer going to pick the people that I thought were good for me, that I was going to let my higher power pick them. And so I let you guys fill me up. I went to a lot of meetings. I was of service. I did conventions. And so I was getting very full. And the last thing I wanted was a partner, because my life was great and I was full and I didn't need anybody. And then walks in Sweet Tea. And, you know, Sweet Tea is available. It's reliable, consistent, has a program. But Sweet Tea had just come out of another relationship, and I've already been there, done that. That was the last thing that I wanted to do, is just pick up somebody else's pieces. And I was very uncertain that that's what I wanted to do. So my sponsor does one of those movie nights that she does. And I walk in, and I see Sweet Tea's Jeep outside of the car, and I was like, great, because I've already heard that the person's interested in me, and I was pissed. I was like, I'm okay being single. I don't need to be set up. And the person was trying to make conversation with me, and I was like, nope, I'm okay. I have program. I don't need you. You know, and the next day in meditation, the message that I heard was, this is somebody you walk with, not someone you leave behind. And I felt like an ass. Because I didn't need that anymore. I forgot that I had a higher power. And so, you know, it was a very difficult road, because I knew that there were things there that needed to be mended. And so I wanted to control and manage that. And what step are you working around that? And are you clear around that? And it was then that I realized, you know, that's an outside issue. I'm an outside issue to that person's past. I'm an outside issue to whatever was going on with them. You know, God's the master surgeon. My job is just to walk next to that person and not make their wounds any bigger or greater. And so today my journey has been amazing in trusting that higher power and knowing that everything will be provided for me. To me, step 10 is a lot about self-care, being vigilant, self-compassion, not beating myself up over things. Without prayer and meditation, I don't know that I would be here, because that's my biggest guidance today. I am of service to others. I do a lot in the program, and this is why I'm here. you know, the theme of the conference is living in the now, and that sometimes it's hard because I've had shame come up in my life. I've had horrible things come up like that, and living in the now is a good reminder that I am powerless over my past, that I don't have to beat myself up over things that I have no control over, that I have a higher power today that's gonna give me whatever I want and then more. All I need to do is ask, that I'm worthy of love and loving. So I'm very grateful for that. I wanna close with a reading from one of our spiritual books. It's called As We Understood. And it's basically a lot of compilations about higher power. And then this page, it reads, "My life was void of such things as mental and emotional sobriety, peace of mind, serenity, and unselfish love. Such things cannot enter a life that is cluttered with resentments, self-pity, selfishness, intolerance, and all the other defects of character known to those of us who become ill as we do. Then I walked into this flowing mass of love and felt the healing power. Through God's grace, the Al-Anon program, and my own efforts, I became whole again. I became a part of this love because I was enabled once more to love and accept love. Is there a greater blessing?" Thank you all for letting me be of service.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.